Welcome to episode 20 of the Field Day Podcast, brought to you by the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation. I am your host, Jordan Haywisher, Director of Water Quality and Research for Farm Bureau. Today's guest is Ben Brown from The Ohio State University. We're talking a little farm risk management, a little trade, little farm markets. So as you know, if you're a farmer, if you're out harvesting your corn or soybeans or, you know, planting cover crops or doing whatever this fall, hopefully this will give you a little kickstart to thinking about how to market that grain or plan for next year. So had a good conversation with Ben. And as always, if you guys have any questions, please reach out. And I hope that this conversation helps. Enjoy. All right, we'll get started here. So we will start with what's your name, who you are, where you come from, where you've been, that whole thing.
Absolutely. My name is Ben Brown. I serve as an assistant professor of professional practice in agriculture risk management at Ohio State University. I love my job. I would consider myself a Buckeye and Ohio resident now, but I do range from the Western Corn Belt, Missouri and Kansas, but thrilled to be in the Buckeye State.
Yeah, so how's that adjustment been? Obviously, we grow a lot of the similar things. Maybe scale's a little bit different. So what's the biggest difference between where you grew up and your operation on your family farm to like what you have to deal with in Ohio?
Yeah, it is very similar. And in fact, I was actually surprised when I got here how similar the conditions were and just the overall structure of both the urban-rural relationships, because Missouri has, while not as densely populated of a state as Ohio is, we do have two large metropolitan areas in Kansas City and St. Louis. We've got a pretty nice forested area of the Ozark Mountain Range, whereas Ohio's got the Appalachian Range. So there are some dynamics that you see that are very similar. I would say that the scale is probably the biggest difference in terms of, you know, just farm size, access to all your fields within a certain radius. But the trade-off for that is our yields and soil quality aren't as high as what you all have here in Ohio and what I get to deal with now being a resident.
So. Yeah. So how much, we'll go off topic here for a second, how many people who have watched the Ozarks or Ozarks on Netflix, I think it is, with Jason Bateman, mm-hmm. know that it's actually where it's at? Do they have any clue, do you think, that it's like an actual like place, like you think, because I know you do, but like,
absolutely,
I feel like people
yeah.
just see the show and they're like, oh, it's in the mountains somewhere, or it's in the hills, or it's in the...
And normally, sometimes that gets brought up when I say I'm from Missouri and people have seen the show yeah. and they go, well, where do you live in relation to the Ozarks? So yeah. I think it is kind of a general, I think they sometimes maybe get curious enough that they Google, you know, yeah. where is Ozark,
that's
Missouri
true.
Or something. And it is, we are fortunate, it's about an hour away from where I grew up, not too far down the road. And we used to go down there. It was kind yeah. of the vacation spot.
Yeah.
And as farm families will understand, when you have both livestock and crops, there's not a big break in the year. And so you tend to, if you get a good rainstorm in the summer, you tend to take 3 days and go to the lake. And,
yeah.
and that was kind of our pastime as well. So.
Cool. Well, we'll get back on topic. But so your title and what you do is probably a little bit convoluted versus, like, what's the biggest way you, or best way you can break down what is your main duty at Ohio State?
Yeah, it's probably twofold, or really threefold, I guess. Ag policy, how federal farm policy and commodity programs fit into a business structure of an operation. Grain marketing and market analysis is probably the area that I spend a good chunk, if not the majority of my time in. And then the back end of this all really feeds into financial performance,
yeah.
managing financial liquidity moving forward, cash flow expectations and farm business decisions based on how much money is on hand, where we think prices are going to go, and forecasting business growth. So,
yeah, so a tough but yet intriguing year, I guess, for your sector. You know, it's like a lot of things have happened to move markets. You have trade issues, you have you know, weather either regionally or nationally, and so I would imagine it's a fairly cool part of the your career because there's a lot of stuff going on. But explain, kind of give us like the rundown of how, you know, the farm market has been in the last, you know, year or so.
I would say that every day has been a surprise. I wouldn't say I go in any day saying I'm going to do this and that's what I do, right? Everything changes from the moment I walk in the door to by the time I end at the end of the day, just because we have a bunch of fluctuations within the day. But then even in the commodity market sector, the old verbiage is that the market's never wrong. And I used to believe that. And to some extent, you know, there is validity to that statement that is the price, that is the market. However, that would assume that the market has perfect information all the time, right? And so we tend to, you know, see opportunities where there's maybe things that the market hasn't figured in or figured in to the extent that they should or have overreacted to something, and we can make assumptions based on that. Whether we're wrong or not, that's where kind of the speculating comes in, if you will. But the reason I bring this up, and the reason I think it's related to your question, is there were some things this year that we thought, you know, as soon as they came out or as soon as it was announced that the market would react, and it wouldn't, it would to an extreme way, and we'd sit there and say, well, that's going to overreact. But then to a certain extent, it was how long down the road can we expect to see some type of reaction? And it would surprise us sometimes. I mean, we'd expect it in a week, and maybe it wouldn't come till a month later. And so we'd see these you know, risks pop up that were surprising. It was kind of like whack-a-mole at the county fair. You hit it down over here, and it pops up somewhere else at an unknown time. That was largely what we saw in the markets all year, whether it was trade or weather or anything. It was
just a surprise. What has caused that is because it's such because we're at a lower price to begin with on a lot of the commodities, or what do you think has caused that?
Well, we got kind of comfortable a little bit, and I think, and when I say we, I'm putting this in as market analysts, I'm putting it in as farmers, as end users of products, or just even the broader market of speculators in general as well. We kind of got comfortable knowing what to expect. I mean, we didn't really see huge variation changes. We pretty much saw the last 5 or 6 years pretty good crops in general across the Corn Belt. Some states maybe had some variation in that, if you will. But overall, you know, we saw very little variation from our ending yield to what was projected at the beginning of harvest or even in the middle of the summer. And there wasn't much of this variation. You throw in 19 and really the end of 18 with all the weather we had that delayed fall field work in 2018 that then really kind of compressed a shorter season, if you will, in the spring of 19. And you start to see some of these things that we just haven't seen before, that whether it was trade, whether it was a winter storm in the northern plains last couple weeks, just things that we haven't had to experience in the last 5 years, and we probably became a little bit immune to not having them and having to think about them just because they hadn't been at the forefront for quite a while, and we just kind of lost track of where we were.
Yeah. So you talk about the storms. So the storms really didn't do much to the pricing in the Great Plains, like you, because it's like essentially snowstorms that were drifting as high as what the corn was about to be harvested.
Yeah,
essentially.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and even that, but then just even the cold temperatures, right? In terms of wind chill, but then just the absolute temperature to begin with. We saw places in western Nebraska, South Dakota, North Dakota that stayed below freezing for days, multiple days, and several hours. And so, you know, that does harm for a crop that's not at maturity yet. And that was kind of one of the other big surprises we had in 2019 was we're in unknown territory about some of this crop development. Even it's not just some of these things that are stacked on top of each other. It's also we don't know what to expect for some of these stacks. One of those being crop development in an extremely late planted year, looking at can we get enough growing degree units in back months of September and October to get us to maturity before a frost. And so you start taking that into account. And to get to your question about the Northern Plains in specific, if you take what USDA had reported in terms of how much of the crop had been at maturity, we were looking at about 1.2 billion bushels of corn, or 10% of our corn acres that could have been drastically affected and probably is to some extent, but we're just not seeing the reaction to it. And we're seeing about 550 million bushels of soybeans that potentially could have been affected in that storm. We're just not really seeing a drastic uptick to the magnitude of everything kind of got hammered. We are seeing positives, and they're coming from both weather and yields coming in other places a little bit softer than what was expected. But it's things like that where we're still trying to grapple with if we have a large portion of the crop not at maturity, can we still get it mature before our first frost? Even here in the eastern Corn Belt in Ohio and Indiana, where we have large amounts of late planted corn and soybeans, or just not planted corn and soybeans.
Yeah, I mean that's an interesting point. You see. I drive all over the state, or mostly northwest, western Ohio, and I see, even yesterday I was driving to Logan County, and it's like I saw beans that were starting to turn that were shin high, ankle high. It's like there's so many things. I think there's so many acres out there that maybe if you flew over them or you looked at them from the road, you'd say, oh, like that's a cornfield. But then as you get into the yields, who knows what that – what that yield's going to be.
Not even just field by field, but even within fields, we're seeing huge variations within the field. I've talked to producers here in Ohio that They had a field of soybeans that they've been watching all summer that they thought was actually looking pretty good and expecting to make 60 bushels an acre, and they get into the field and it's making 40,
yeah.
You know, 35 or 40. They've also got fields that they think are going to make 40 and they're making 55, right?
Yep.
And so, I mean, it's been really hard to gauge without, you know, taking into account the full field, because you can start on one end and your yield monitor shows something different by the time you get to the other end of the field.
So yeah.
Extreme variation all across the board.
Yeah, and so like that was a note for me is like, so like if you're a farmer in Ohio, like you're paying attention to the weather, you're paying attention to the markets to a certain degree, like as a like essentially like risk assessor or economist or whatever. How do you actually sleep with all this stuff going on? Like you have storms out in the Great Plains that's dumping, you know, all this snow. You have trade talk. You have you know, maybe a frost that's coming into the Midwest. Like how does your brain shut off when you're trying to, you're enthusiastically trying to gauge all of these things that are affecting corn prices?
Well, as an economist that works in all those areas, I don't sleep right now. That's the short answer for producers or just even myself. And I have to continue to remind myself this. You can't keep up with everything. You'll drown yourself right now if you try to keep up with some of these, you know, whether it's disaster programs, whether it's MFP, whether it's commodity programs, whether it's weather, whether it's trade, possible trade deals, right? If you try to keep up with the moving targets within each one of those topics, you'll eventually just drown yourself and wear yourself out.
Yeah, especially with technology, with like Twitter and 24-hour news.
Absolutely. You've got access to stuff all the time, and you can... We used to hear this a little bit in school, right? They would say, you know, we never did. I wouldn't necessarily say I was a great student to where I just kept researching or whatever. But I remember there was a couple of times where people would tell me, okay, you just got to stop. One of the things to know is when do you stop and feel like you have enough to make a decision on?
Yeah.
And the truth is that point is relevant in agriculture. You want to know enough to make an informed decision. We want to help you at Ohio State, or whether it's Farm Bureau, whether it's any other commodity organization. We want to help make a decision. And help alleviate some of that pressure, because if you try to take it all on, it leads to extreme stress and just leads to an overwhelming burden of stress. That's the best word, is just stress.
Yeah. So. No, that makes sense. So you talked about, you know, financial planning essentially, or how, you know, helping create information so farmers can make decisions on kind of their long-term financial planning. It's like, what's the status of that now that we know, okay, commodity prices are where they're at, a lot of prevent plant, a lot of a weird year, obviously, for farmers. Where are we at with, the confidence in farmers to be able to say, this is how much money or this is how much stuff I have available at my disposal when I'm trying to plan for the future?
Yeah, and just like we talked about earlier, we're in crop development. In crop production, we've got huge amounts of variation across the board. We're seeing that in the farm sector, in the farm balance sheets. I sometimes see aggregate totals of, farmers have this much debt or farmers have this much equity. And I almost start wanting to cringe at that moment from the standpoint that we are so variable in terms of each balance sheet, whether it's in Ohio or whether it's across the Corn Belt, that I almost feel like we're being inaccurate by giving, you know, just aggregate estimates of the total compiled unit. And so we see that huge variation across everything. I think depending on where you are in terms of that scale, makes management decisions in 2019, you know, even more important, and they're probably important for everybody. But we've got some farms that, you know, we see and we look at, and they're extremely financially stressed in terms of highly leveraged, and it's hard for us to see, you know, a strong path forward unless we see big improvements in markets, or, you know, something like a crazy yield that gets a higher revenue. Mm-hmm. But then even on the other side of that coin, we've got challenges for farms that potentially are, you know, well managed, have low leverage, and are facing obstacles such as almost having too much cash on hand and having huge financial tax burdens. A prime example would be, you know, some of our farms here in Ohio that have started calling in and asking questions related mostly to tax management, but then also financial planning, which was kind of your question. Because 2018, we had extremely strong crops in Ohio, and especially, you know, the western part of Ohio. We had extremely good crops. Most of them held that in the bin and then sold it in 2019. So they were able to generate a significant amount of cash, liquid cash, by selling those crops, getting ready for the 2019 harvest. A lot of them had an MFP 2018 payment that then they then rolled into 2019, because at that time we were also thinking, we were told, you know, not to expect a 2019 payment. So we were thinking about, you know, we had the information at hand and we were thinking about managing taxes from that standpoint. And it looked like it might be a good idea to roll some of that into 2019. And I still stand by that decision from the standpoint that based on the information we had and the promise that there was going to be no additional trade aid, that that seemed like a decent idea. But we then had the 2019 MFP payments.
And what's an MFP, just in case?
The Market Facilitation Program, you know, money that comes out of the Credit Commodity Corporation to help alleviate some of the damage faced by low commodity prices, retaliatory tariffs by the Chinese, is helping to facilitate some of that. But it is generating cash, right? That's a very liquid asset, liquid just being able to turn into cash. Cash is the most liquid form of asset we have. And so you had the 2018 MFP payments, you had cash from selling a huge crop, potentially holding that over into 2019. Then we add in the 2019 MFP payment that will get classified in this year as well. And for some of our producers in the state, unfortunately, we had large acreage of prevent plant, and that'll come in the form of, guess what, a cash payment as well. So we're dealing with maybe a different scenario than what we've dealt with ever, from the standpoint that instead of carrying grain into a marketing year or holding it for another marketing year and being able to, if needing cash, turn that commodity into a liquid asset, now we've got liquid assets and cash but nothing in the bin to sell if we get into a hard spot. So we definitely don't want to spend it all.
Yeah.
And if we need some of that in 2019 because there's nothing in the reserve, if you will. So, I mean, that creates some management strategies there as well.
And farmers aren't exactly the most eager, not like anybody is to keep that and pay taxes on the whole lump sum. So it'll be interesting to see what some of them choose to do with that money. Because, I mean, there's a lot of volatility, obviously, with weather changes and just the way the markets have been. So it'll be very interesting to see how that pans out for some people.
Absolutely. I mean, if we just look at the entire economy in terms of the ag sector as a whole, right, and we look at other areas and our friends and brothers in the ag retail sector, right, they had a rough year too. In fact, they had an extremely rough year from the standpoint that a lot of them, you know, took back product that farmers weren't able to put in the ground. And so they saw a hit at their bottom dollar, if you will, at the ag retail level. And so they're kind of counting on farmers reinvigorating their purchases. And so they're out there trying to encourage, you know, people to spend money. And again, it's for their vitality and as an organization as well. And so we're kind of dealing with that too a little bit, that they had a rough year too, and not to forget about them.
Yeah. So what are some of the tools? I mean, I know if a farmer's listening to this, they probably know some of the stuff. What are some of the common tools that are at the hands of farmers to do some of this planning, or even just programs which they can enter to kind of help with this market fluctuation?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, from the financial side, in terms of cash management, if you will, in terms of asset management a little bit, you know, the way the federal tax legislation is now set up, it is quite complex. We all had that promise of a postcard, right? We were going to be able to do our taxes on a postcard. Well, we can, right? In theory, the front page is the size of half a page, not necessarily a postcard, but half a page. But then there's about 8 or 9 sheets of schedules that come along with it. And so it has become pretty complex. Most people now have tax preparers that help them work through that process. But, you know, there are some opportunities within the tax legislation to defer some payments. I mentioned about deferring MFP payments and things of the like. It doesn't look like we're going to be able to defer 2019 payments, as those will have to be paid. Or you're going to receive all of that in 2019. There isn't an overlap of payout into 2020. But so, I mean, we've got a little bit of challenge there. But tax management probably does provide some of the best cases. But again, it's probably something you're going to want to have that conversation with your tax preparer, just because they're going to know your operation better than anybody, you know, outside of yourself, better than anybody. In terms of like market fluctuation, we have seen some support through the Farm Bill for marketing loan rates. So if producers do stick their crop in the bin, they have a crop to sell at a later time, and they need some money to free up some early season discounting, or even, you know, pay down some debt or something early in the season to avoid interest costs, you know, they can get a lower interest marketing loan rate that does help free up some cash, and those were increased in the 2018 Farm Bill. So that was helpful, and I think it will be significant for producers moving forward. Outside of that, we have multiple commodity programs to help basically smooth out revenue from year to year. If you think of crop insurance, it's kind of the revenue smoother within a year from beginning to end and making some of those plans. But our federal commodity programs, like the Agriculture Risk Coverage Program or the Price Loss Coverage Program, tend to, their idea is not necessarily to provide you risk management within a year, but to provide you risk management across years. And so we do have those tools at our disposal as well. So we've kind of taken a full portfolio of that is from the public option side. One of the private options is options and futures markets. We encourage producers to at least consider it. And it does have some risk. I mean, they do take on production risk, if you will, and you have a contract. But there are ways to help mitigate some of those downside risks through futures and options contracts that can be helpful to producers on the private side of the ledger. So
nice. How many? I know not everybody does. Like, how many people do you think, or what percentage of farmers in Ohio don't even utilize like crop insurance, for example?
So we have high crop insurance adoption. If we look at corn and soybean acres together, and I'd have to do some work to get the other crops, but for corn and soybeans, we're looking at about 80% of corn and soybean farmers that do use crop insurance. For the 20% that does not, there's a variety of reasons. In some cases, they're just self-insured, meaning that they have enough off the farm income to get them in a year, to help them in mm-hmm. a year where they might have low revenue or low yields and they can survive. We see diversification in some cases where a farm just has, land spread out over a wide enough area that they're basically providing their own insurance, hoping that, it's not going to be whatever the disaster is, it's going to be widespread enough to affect everything. But mostly it's a variety of reasons, probably the biggest one being just off-farm income or off income sources that provide enough to get through a down year. So.
Nice. So you talked about options in the future. So if we're looking through Ben's crystal ball, what's the next? What does it look like as we're in the middle of harvest 2020? What would you think would be the trajectory for commodity prices if we're saying just corn and soybeans?
Mm-hmm. So we have seen both come up about 20 cents. Soybeans a little bit stronger, more so than corn in the last couple of weeks. And when I say 20 cents, I'm talking about the nearby futures contracts, which would be November futures for soybeans and December futures for corn. One of the market terms that we use a lot is market carry. Market carry is basically the difference between two futures months of the same commodity. And you can do across commodities if you want to, but so a common one for corn is maybe the March futures contract or the May futures contract versus the December futures contract, and looking at, can we cover our storage costs by moving out to a future month? What market carry tells us is what the market's telling us to do with our grain. If we have very low market carry and we have a very shallow, forward-looking outlook, that tends to tell us that the market's wanting grain now and bringing it into the elevator and helping with it. If we see a big market carry, that's the market telling us, incentivizing farmers to keep that grain on farm, wait till a later period of time to then bring it into the elevator. And so it is kind of telling. It doesn't necessarily, I always like to remind producers that the market isn't necessarily telling us what the price is going to be, in March or in May, but it's giving us signals about what to do with our grain now to help, that the market's asking for. And so the market has been very shallow, saying that they want the grain now. And talking with elevators and end users, it does seem like they're sourcing and looking for grain at the moment. And so I think that's creating a very tight picture. The real story on soybeans, to break soybeans away from corn just a little bit, the real story is our trade situation with China. We had a what I'm going to call an amazing development. I don't really have a great term for it because it's not really what I want to say, but it was a couple of months ago we were over 1 billion bushels of carry out of soybeans. In our latest analysis and latest report, we're down to 460 million bushels of soybeans, which is just amazing to consider that we chopped that many soybeans out of the balance sheet to get where we're at. And we can thank some of the prevent plant acres really for that cause. But it got us to a point where we're seeing soybean prices at cost of production for most people, which is a big positive because it, it wasn't looking like we were going to get soybean prices up to a cost of production. So at least in terms of moving out forward, I think we are going to have, again, crystal balls are, it's always the million-dollar question, right? If I had an accurate crystal ball, I'd be rich. But, you know, I think we're going to have opportunities above cost of production, corn and soybeans. On the soybean side, thanks to some of the prevent plant acres and reducing that carry out. But I do think for both corn and soybeans, we're going to have opportunities to market grain above cost of production, which is positive.
Yeah, it's interesting with soy, you know, a big reason why China's demand hasn't been as big is because of African swine fever. And then part of the reason why inventory may help us a little bit on our side is because of prevent plant. Two things that are normally catastrophic and still kind of are, but are essentially kind of being odd players in this trade war, so to speak, because they're not normal, not a normal thing that's happened generally on both sides of the fence.
Yeah, you hear a lot of people talk, whether it's farmers or whether it's ag economists, wondering, you know, if China would have been as aggressive in this trade negotiation or trade war, if you will, if they hadn't had the issues with African swine fever that they did. And I'm kind of in the camp that they didn't know the severity of it at the time that this all really started to take place. And I think they've made adjustments based on what they've needed from protein development stuff. But this is also an opportunity for China to really reform their pork industry. They had a pork industry made up of a lot of backyard pigs and just kind of local products. And they've been looking for, I'm saying this in a way that makes it sound like I'm making a broad statement about their country, but what I'm really saying is, like, China was kind of needing almost a nudge to reform to a modern system just because they weren't under any type of incentives, whether that was market-based or financially incentive-based or even capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
They just weren't making those large-scale modern changes in agriculture that we're now seeing them make, basically to take into account some of the, you know, sanitary restrictions related to pork production. So
yeah, because a couple past episodes we had talked about African swine fever specifically, and my question was about the repopulation.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and how long
hurdles.
Does this take? Yeah, how long does this take? And how quickly can they get back up to speed? I read something yesterday that, you know, now their analysts are projecting that their pork production is down 41%.
Yeah,
it wasn't that long ago that we were only talking about 20% and 25%. So it's really become a major issue. And when we're talking about an increase, I mean, let's keep in mind just how big of a pork producer China is, the world's largest pork producer and consumer. You know, 20% dock in their pork supply is equivalent to a lot of countries put together, including the United States.
Yes.
So very big pork supplier.
Yeah. So with China, I mean, I know there was a, you know, we've been through this before, I guess, but there's a phase one or whatever they're calling it, trade agreement with China. I mean, this is October 17th today, so who knows what the 18th or the 25th.
As I said earlier at the beginning of this, every day is different. Every day is different.
So what kind of stock or what kind of confidence do you put in on where we can come to some sort of agreement with China? I mean, I know this nearly impossible answer, but what's your gut feeling?
Well, it's one of those that I actually think that this partial agreement or phase one agreement that we've started hearing about in the last couple of weeks, I've thought for a while that some type of partial agreement, or we call it a shallow deal, you know, where you're not getting everything, you're not getting all the reforms, but you're at least getting something. I always thought that was probably more on the table than asking for all the reforms. Just because I didn't think we'd come to agreement. Those take lots of, you know, negotiators and a lot of time and multiple years. I mean, we saw this with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It was a long-term deal that took us a while to get, you know, that agreement just even through the process. And so to ask for those type of structural reforms was just going to take a long time in general. And so I felt like for U.S. agriculture, a shallow deal to where we could get some trade flowing back again, I thought was a positive. Again, it's not everything, and it's not going to meet all the needs of everyone. But at least I think that's probably the direction we're heading. Now, whether this phase one gets through, that's when we see it on paper and when China, you know, fully starts supporting it on their end, like what we're hearing on our end, you know, then I'll start to really put some stock behind it because we've been here before.
Yeah.
We've been in this spot a couple of times.
What's the biggest sticking point, I guess? I mean, there's always all sorts of information that gets thrown around in the public. I guess boil it down, like, what's the biggest sticking point between the two countries?
Yeah, I'm going to give you an analogy. This is the analogy I've been using a lot lately. If you take the NFL Super Bowl team, winning team, so I guess that would be the Patriots. I'm a Chiefs fan, yeah. and I love the Browns and Bengals too, but you know, we'll use the Patriots. You know, if you take the Patriots, the Super Bowl winning team, and you put them on a field, and you take the winner of the World Soccer Cup, for instance, right, and you put them on the other side of the field, both of them are going to show up to play the game of football, but that looks differently for both of them, right? They play with different rules, different styles, right? One is very high speed. In terms of soccer, you're making adjustments in the flow. There's really not a set plan, and things change on every instant of every play, right? Whereas in football, it's more methodical. It's thought out. Each play starts with, you know, an intention of, we're going to do this play. We're going to stop. We're going to reset. We're going to make our decision. And I think that's a great analogy for what we're seeing with the U.S.-China relationship from the standpoint that it is, you know, while football is America's, or NFL football is America's game, or, you know, a sport that we hold dear here in the United States, it's really the Chinese that are playing that slow, methodical, long-term type plan. And short and long-term mean different things for both sides. In the United States, short and long-term is, I'll just say it the way it is, it's one election cycle. That's short and long-term, it's the same thing. Short-term in China is, you know, 100 years. Long-term is 500 years, right? I mean, we're talking about two different rules of the game that we're trying to play and trying to get the other team to play with us. So that's the problem, is we just haven't come to the terms of how the game will be played.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I guess I don't, you know, that's, I'm just always curious about what will we ever, I know, what if we ever will come to an agreement, because I know there's a lot of talk about, you know, protecting IP and things like that. And I, you know, I'm neither of us are experts in that. It's just some things on that side of the non-agricultural side seem to be hard to keep them compliant, I guess, if they do agree on anything. So it'd be interesting to see what happens with that. So we recently had some sort of agreement with Japan, correct? Do you have anything to say about that agreement? I don't know a lot of details about it. It's a bad interview question, but we're kind of straight here. So what can you tell me about our recent agreement?
Well,
with
this
Japan?
Japan was probably the United States' biggest interest going into the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, the other interest of that deal was that was creating another economic unit to help realign China to play fairly in the world market. So, in a way, by us pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, we lost access to a market that we were really trying to gain access to in Japan, and we were also trying to get reforms in China, right? So it was kind of tackling two of our big goals, TPP was, in a way. We've decided to, you know, challenge China and try to get reforms from them through a bilateral way, one-on-one. But then we've also tried to form those bilateral agreements with some of those countries in the Trans-Pacific Partnership as well, and Japan being probably the biggest one that we had. And so if I had anything really to just say in terms of the trade with Japan is now we're at least being able to compete in a fair environment with some of our competitors. And while that might sound like I'm giving a shallow answer, I'm not giving a lot of details, I just don't want to simplify the magnitude of just being able to compete with some of our fellow countries that had access and advantage over us as ag producers in the United States.
Because I guess explain to me why we pulled out of the TPP to begin with.
President Trump campaigned on it that he would pull us out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And, I mean, multiple other candidates did as well. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just him. But he campaigned on that, and he followed through on his promise. And so on day one, he pulled us out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Part of his rationale behind that, whether you agree with it or not, it was that, you know, he prefers bilateral one-on-one country deals versus multilateral several nations together in one pact, right? And his reasoning for that is if you're one-on-one deals, you have more leverage over your trading partner than if you're in a trading pact with multiple other countries. I actually, you know, multilateral deals get you a lot of access all at the same time. They tend to be a little bit more uniform, right, in terms of access. Maybe you don't get everything you want, but you sometimes pick up things that you weren't even trying to get, and now you have a benefit that you weren't planning on. So, I mean, that's always my preferred method as an ag economist. The multilateral deal is my preferred. But I don't really have anything against a bilateral agreement or multiple bilateral agreements. I would just say that you simply have to have them. If you don't have them, then all of a sudden you're at a disadvantage with those players that are a part of a multilateral system. And that's probably a little bit of the issue or the interest in the Japan agreement. You know, we've been trying to get that for a couple years now, and the fact that we did get it is nice, knowing that we're not going to have to wait another 2 years seeing if we're playing in the Japan market or if we're not. And so we'll have to – I think it's a positive. So.
Nice. What commodities benefit the most with our Japan trade deal? I would assume pork and like small grains, or one of the
disadvantages we did have with Japan was agreement that they had made with the European Union on dairy products. And so I think that's a positive. Having an agreement now with Japan where we're on a level playing field is a positive for dairy products. Wheat would be another one. Some of those small grain, and when I say small, I'm talking about like the physical kernels, not like in terms of significance. But you know, some of those small grain crops, Japan is very significant, either largest or in the top three for almost all of our small grains, which is extremely nice to now be, you know, back into those markets. Beef is another area where I think we're going to see Japan play a very important role in U.S. beef exports. And so I think that's positive because now we're able to match what, to some extent, be closer in line with what New Zealand and Australia have been able to offer the Japanese people. So,
I guess, is there any other topics or programs that you'd want to cover? Anything that's off the top of your head?
Let me think. We've talked about a bunch.
Yeah, we kind of go all over the place here. So,
you know, I can't think of anything right now. You know, we are in the thick of harvest. I'd encourage people to remain aware of your surroundings. A lot of accidents happen at harvest, unfortunately, and so we definitely want to keep everybody in our thoughts and prayers as we move forward. You know, I think just keeping an eye out for markets over the next couple months. I think we are going to see opportunities to move some grain, but I would encourage producers to not get overexcited and hold out too long. One of the things I've heard a lot as of lately was that people wish they would have been more aggressive with the fundamental signs that we saw earlier in 2019. You know, there's nothing wrong for not taking. It's just, you know, now they're facing a little bit of regret, and you know, that adds to stress as well. So we want to keep all those opportunities in front of us and at least consider them when they arise. So
awesome. Well, I think that's all we got for you.
Excellent. Thank you, Jordan. Appreciate it.
And that was Ben Brown from the Ohio State University's Department of Agricultural, Environmental, and Development Economics. If you want to learn more about the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation, please go to ofbf.org. If you want to become a member or look at any member benefits and see what kind of activities we have to support our members of Farm Bureau. And as always, if you want to rate or subscribe, or if you have any topics that you would like for me to explore, please hit me up at JHOEWISCHER@ofbf.org. Thank you.